For the week of May 21st, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 367, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Cannes, France, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in boring old New York, I'm Michael Giltz. So we're on different continents, you're sick, you're not feeling well, you didn't have the right equipment, we're doing the show in a whole crazy new way, and it's later than ever, but by God, we're going to get it done.
Yeah, I mean, I am very, very sick. Look, for 18 years, I've avoided getting sick during camp.
Well done. And now the rain is over.
Yes, but you know, look, I'm in Cannes. It's sunny. It's rained maybe once the entire time I've been here. And you know what? They're still showing movies here in Cannes, France, during the month of May. For 12 days, they're showing movies. The world's largest film festival. Go figure.
The security lines may be longer than ever, however.
Oh my God, you do not know the half of it. I mean, it is just unbelievable. They've had to start screenings late, and Michael, you know, having been here numerous times for well over a decade, what it's like. They never start a screening late. That was until this year, when they decided, you know what, we're going to make going to a screening in Cannes about as much fun as going to the airport.
Let's not bitch. Because of what's happened around the world. My question is, has there been a change since the terrorist attack in Manchester?
You know what? The security was so tight to begin with, where you would go through a airport security metal detector, and then you'd get wanded. So it was kind of like...
Well, that's what they used to do.
Well, not an airport metal detector. They used to just wand you. So it started, security here in Cannes started with, okay, we got to check your bag. Okay, fine. Then it was, we got to check your bag, and then we have to wand you with a little, you know, handheld metal detector. Now it's, we're going to check your bag, you're going to walk through a metal detector, and then we're going to wand you again. So
does it feel onerous, or does it feel safer?
It feels a little onerous to me. It feels like security theater because, look, most of the people around me I've been seeing for the past 18 years. So unless they all of a sudden change their mind after 18 years.
There's thousands of people. You don't know everybody on site.
That is correct, which is why I don't begrudge them what they're doing.
But you do feel it's mostly just to make us feel better. It's not, you can't really secure a location, which brings me to my question about Manchester. People around the world are now saying, what can we do to make concerts safe? Well, there's no way. You know, you cannot weaponize and make every event and every, you know, restaurant in the world safe from an attack. If somebody wants to be a jerk, they're going to do it. We had McDonald's shootings in the 70s. We didn't turn every McDonald's into a bunker. You know, we've had post office tragedies. We have things happening at concerts now, but there's no practical way to really keep people safe if somebody wants to be a bastard. If somebody wants to rent a car and drive into a crowd, there's obviously nothing you can do about that. I don't say that in a negative sense. I say that in the sense that most of the time, horrible things like that don't happen. But whatever new security measures they put in, it may hopefully make people feel a little safer and better. But it is, to a degree, I think, theater.
Yes, and what we're talking about, of course, is this, you know, kind of terrorist attack at the Ariana...
Ariana Grande, terrorist attack. Yeah.
In Manchester. And yes, they held a moment of silence here in Cannes for it. There are a lot of people walking around Cannes. I mean, a lot of gendarme and military folks walking around with very big guns. And they walk in packs of about four or five. And you see them, if you walk down the Croisette, the main strip in front of the beach here that leads right to the Palais des Festivals, you will definitely run into more than one or two groups of them. And they are very ominous looking. In regards to the concert in Manchester, you know, this is something that where the person seems to have run into the lobby. So before security, you know, before you would have gone through security, that's where this person decided to attack this event.
At the end of the show.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like, you know, how far do you remove the security? Do you start putting it outside? Do you start putting it in the parking lot? Do you start putting it, you know, in the streets before the parking lot? There's only so far you can go, as you just mentioned.
Right. I don't say it in the sense of despair. You'd want to take reasonable precautions, but, you know, you're not strip searching and patting people down. So people can still smuggle in, you know, the little flask of alcohol or whatever illicit stuff they may be doing. And bad people can still do bad things. You know, the reaction should not be to hunker down and turn every event into a war zone. I don't think that's a way to live. But maybe we'll be looking at Israel and see how that country's much higher state of security level, which is omnipresent throughout their lives every day. Maybe that's how the world will be in the future. I don't know.
Well, yeah. And I guess I should mention up front that I am outside in Cannes. So if you hear birds or planes or people yelling and screaming, it's because I'm literally in the middle of Cannes as we record this.
Are you on a balcony?
I am on a balcony, yes.
Very nice. Do you have a lovely view?
I have a lovely view of the apartments across the street.
And do you have a lovely view of what we'll be talking about this week on Showbiz Sandbox?
Well, in fact, I do, because this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're going to dive into the Cannes Film Festival, as we've been discussing. Netflix is sucking up all the oxygen here, but that may be because not a lot of the movies are catching fire yet. Not a lot of regular movies, that is, but a virtual reality film may be pointing the way to the future. During our book filter segment, Michael, you're going to talk about The Hot New War, hint, think MASH. On Inside Baseball, we'll give you another look at the TV upfronts and everything we learned about the state of television. If this is the era of peak TV, how come everything the networks are trotting out seems to be so boring? But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull info from other areas, and the studios are panicking because the summer box office is down 10%. What happened last year? It was like the biggest year of all time?
Yes, it
right.
was.
Okay, so it's just early in the summer. The summer may pick up, but every year cannot be bigger than the year before. That's an insane standard, so let's just wait till we get to the end of the year and see where we're at. But anyway, right now we have a movie at topping the box office, and it's Alien Covenant. $66 million over the weekend, $117 million worldwide, plus good reviews. Much better than Alien Prometheus. And number two around the world is Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, another $63 million for that film. That's at $730 million worldwide. Will that get to $1 billion? We're going to have to cross our fingers. And number three is the flop, King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, $34 million over the weekend, and it's just about to hit $100 million worldwide. But unlike Alien Covenant and Guardians, it's falling fast. And number four is Dangal, the Indian film that has played so well in China that it's rewriting the rule books as far as how well movies can do in China from India. Hasn't been a lot of crossover yet. Before this movie, the highest grossing Indian film made like $15 million or $12 million. This one is at like 100. I mean, it's just making a ton of money. It's at $32 million on the weekend, $128 million worldwide. And number five is the horror flick Get Out, $13 million this weekend, $230 million worldwide. And number six is Life. That's the sci-fi flick starring Jake Gyllenhaal, another $13 million. That, too, is about to hit the $100 million mark. It's not looking good for that movie, but it's not quite done yet. It's playing in 20 territories right now. And number seven is a North American debut. It's Everything, Everything. It's a young adult disease romance movie. It's a subgenre where young teenagers get sick, are dying, and they fall in love. I think they've got it backwards, but what can I say? I'm an old guy. $12 million it made on opening weekend, so it had an okay start. And number eight is the Amy Schumer comedy Snatched. $10 million on the weekend, $40 million worldwide. That's exactly about what it costs to make. Exactly about? Is that a phrase? I don't think so.
I don't think so.
No, I don't think that's a phrase. It cost about $40 million to make. It's grossed that amount worldwide, but it's got a ways to go. And with Goldie Hawn in the cast list, maybe that movie will play a lot better worldwide. And number nine is The Fate of the Furious, $1.2 billion in counting, which is right around Beating the Beast, which is at $1.2 billion in counting. There's $10 million separating those two films. In between them is The Boss Baby, which is at $470 million and looking to claw its way to $500 million worldwide. It's okay. It's all gravy at this point because it cost $125 million to make. So that Alec Baldwin animated film is definitely in the black. Another launch in North America is Diary of a Wimpy Kid, The Long Haul. And it's going to be a long haul for this movie to make its money back. It'll be okay, though. It made $7 million on the weekend, but didn't get great reviews. There'd been a break in the franchise. They had to recast the lead because the original star has grown out of it. Some fans are upset, though. You know, time marches on, guys. What are you going to do? Unless you follow the Wimpy Kid into college, which is not what that franchise is about. It just doesn't work anymore. So, you know, we'll have to see if they're able to keep this one going. At number 13 is How to Be a Latin Lover. That's just about to hit $50 million worldwide. And number 14, The Merciless. This is a South Korean crime film about a new prisoner teaming up with an inmate to take over the gang that rules the prison. Shockingly, he's a very good-looking new prisoner. It's amazing how some very good-looking people get thrown into jail when you're in the movies. That made $3.4 million on its opening weekend. We don't know the budget, but, you know, it's probably not a great start, not a great opening. We'll have to see where it ends up. But if you know how much The Merciless cost, if you're in South Korea and you can let us know, contact us. Why don't you?
Yes, you can write to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is Showbiz Sandbox, or you can like us on Facebook. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up, and you can like us there and leave us messages there.
Looking for some new flicks in China, there's a movie called Wine War, which is an action film, not a remake of Sideways. That made a modest $2 million. In Germany, an animated film called Richard the Stork opened up, or actually it probably opened up last weekend, because right now its total is $4 million, and it only made $1 million this weekend. So that may have opened up on a Wednesday or last weekend, we're not sure. And a film from Cannes, Ishmael's Ghosts. That opened up at Cannes. It's a French film about a filmmaker and his wife and their lover. It's played at Cannes. I don't know if it's in competition, but I think it was an opening night film, wasn't it?
It was an opening night film, yes.
And now it's opened in the theaters to the modest returns of $1.1 million.
Yes, I saw the film, and, you know, it's an opening night film, you know.
That's right. And, you know, we love covering movies around the world. And we want to thank Mario Scott, who reached out to us on Facebook and included a story in The Economist about Indian cinema and how not only are they gangbusters all over the world, but how there's a growing trend for Tollywood and Kollywood to catch up with Bollywood, that Indian cinema is not just about Bollywood now. Other regions of the country are coming into their own, scoring on the worldwide market, and it's a fun read. We've got a link in our show notes, and you should check it out.
And this came in from Mario Scott, you said?
That's right. He did it via Facebook.
Wow, that's great. Thank you.
Right, so we're at the Cannes Film Festival, or at least you're at the Cannes Film Festival. We've had fake bomb scares, or false bomb scares, I guess is the way to talk about it. We've got heightened security, but the big news is still Netflix, Netflix, Netflix.
Even today, I mean, I thought, you know, both of the Netflix films have already shown in competition. We had Okja from Bong Joon-ho and the Meyerowitz stories.
Chronicles, no? Stories?
It's stories. I've been calling it the Meyerowitz Chronicles all week, and it's actually the Meyerowitz stories. And it's from Noah Baumbach. I guess, hey, let's talk about those two films first. And Okja, we all know Bong Joon-ho, South Korean director. He has been to the festival at least twice before with Tokyo in 2008, Mother in 2009. Mother is a great film if you get a chance to see it. And he made Snowpiercer. His film was picked up by Netflix and will be out on Netflix June 28th. It will not be going to cinemas. So there's been a lot of controversy over including films in the Cannes Film Festival, the largest film festival in the world, legitimizing those films that will never be seen theatrically in a movie theater.
I don't believe it was picked up by Netflix, but they backed it from the start.
Correct.
They made that movie happen. Okay.
Correct. Yes, it stars Tilda Swinton, Jake Gyllenhaal, some South Korean actors, and it's about a super pig. It's about a corporation that has figured out how to raise super pigs, and they give these super pigs to 26 farmers. There's 26 pigs, and they're
about genetically modified farm animals. I mean, super pigs is a little weird sounding.
That's what they call them in the film.
Oh, okay.
Super pig.
Okay.
Now when it comes time to return that, you know, super pig from Korea back to the corporation in the United States, the farmer says, "Well, I don't want to do that. I've kind of grown accustomed to this pig. It's like my pet." Hijinks ensue. It's an interesting film. It's a little wacky, as you can imagine, but it was received with mixed to positive reviews here in Cannes.
What about the Meyerowitz stories?
The Meyerowitz stories was probably, definitely received a little bit better. It's more of a typical, you know, if you've seen any of Noah Baumbach's films or a Wes Anderson film, it's very much like that, in that vein. Dustin Hoffman plays a sculptor who is of retirement age. He's never really made it. He's kind of a middling sculptor. His contemporaries are all more successful than him. He's twice married. The kids from his first marriage, he never really did quite well with. One is played by Adam Sandler in a very dramatic role. And the other half-brother is played by Ben Stiller. There's a sister, Adam Sandler's sister, is played by Elizabeth Marvel. It's quite funny. The writing is as good as you would expect from Noah Baumbach. It's good. You could actually see this movie doing quite well in theaters, if only because the acting is so good that come Oscar time, there might be some talk for either Dustin Hoffman or an Adam Sandler.
So that movie obviously a little bit better received than Okja.
Right, but both of those movies, everybody wanted to know at the press conference and the interviews all about Netflix. And of course, during the jury press conference, because this is a film festival with a competition, the top prize being the Palme d'Or, which they hand out each year. And, you know, during that, the jury press conference, which Pedro Almodovar, a Spanish filmmaker, is the head of the jury, and Will Smith is on the jury, and there's a whole bunch of other directors and actors and filmmakers on the jury. That was the big topic of, you know, that was the quote that came out of that.
Right, and Almodovar said, "I can't imagine giving the top prize to a film that won't play on a big screen." And Will Smith said, "I got kids. I don't know about you, but like, wake up to the future, people." Because well, they watch movies, they watch streaming, they watch everything. It's just part of their life. They don't make a distinction. There's lots of ways to consume entertainment. And if they can, Netflix can make more stuff happen, I'm all for it, said Will Smith. Tilda Swinton, I thought, had the best comment. She said, "We didn't come here to win awards. We came here to show our film at Cannes." You know, and it was like, that's actually true. It's like, it's the platform. It helps you launch your movie. The Palme d'Or is not exactly a magical commercial stamp of approval, but the attention of the world press matters. However, the head of Netflix said, "Well, you know, we're far less likely to want to come back to Cannes if we can't be competing for the top prize." I thought that was silly.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Pedro Almodovar's statement was taken a little bit out of context. You could tell what he was saying is, I can't imagine films winning awards at film festivals that then can never be seen in their true intent. But the way it came out, it made it sound like, well, I'm not going to.
What didn't we understand? You mean you're saying he would happily vote for a film to win best the Cannes picture that he knew had no theatrical release anywhere in the world?
Well, that's what he then later said to to journalists. He actually came prepared with a statement. He knew this topic would be raised.
Of course.
And he came with a statement that he read. But then it was translated into both Spanish and English and French. It was like a complete muck-up of the translation. Will Smith, keep in mind, I thought what he said was very interesting and somewhat true, but at the same time, not unbiased, because he does have a lot of business with Netflix.
A lot?
Well, yeah, he has a big action film that was produced by Netflix.
Right. And he has lots of movies with big studios. He's a long history with lots of... It's not like he's Adam Sandler doing a four-film deal. You know, he's not biased. He's doing business with Netflix. He's like, hey, they're a player too. Why not?
Part of what he said is, I've got these three kids and they go to the movies twice a week and they also watch Netflix. They do both. Right. And I thought, you know, I said, well, let's go back to how your kids go to the movies twice a week. Like, you know, I have trouble finding, you know, time once a month to take my kids to the movies.
Well, they don't need to be taken. I think they're a little bit older than that.
Yes.
And they've always got the nanny. So anyway, to sum up again, every award has rules. If you want to win an Oscar, you have to release your movie in New York or LA for at least a week, right? You have to have a theatrical release. Nobody thinks that's bizarre or crazy. Nobody yells and screams about that. If Cannes has the same rule, well, there, so be it, right?
Yeah,
everybody has rules. Grammys, BAFTAs, Oscars, Emmys, you name it. The fact is, however, the Emmys have changed their rules in recent years to say they want to acknowledge streaming because that's where a lot of business is happening. I think Cannes has just instituted this rule. They did not have it before. There was no requirement that your film have a theatrical release in France. It's just a new situation that came up, and they thought, well, now that it's arisen, we do want to make sure that films get a theatrical release in France. But I imagine in a few years, they might change their mind again.
Well, however, think about it this way, to give you some sense of whether they will or will not change their mind. Jane Campion is here, and just yesterday, you know, she's a filmmaker. She's won the Palme d'Or before with The Piano. Just yesterday, she brought Top of the Lake, the second season of Top of the Lake, to the festival. They screened all 6.5 hours of it.
Right, it's a TV show.
And it's a TV show, and they're doing Twin Peaks on Friday. So David Lynch's Twin Peaks.
Now, well, that's TV. That's a different issue, of course.
Right. And so that's a whole different issue. You're absolutely right. But what I'm saying is, you know, they're beginning to... Yeah, they're kind of changing their approach to certain art forms, as you can see.
Well, they're, the artists that they are loyal to, Jane Campion and David Lynch, are working in TV, and they see it as a worthy thing of showcasing. It's not up for the top prize, of course.
No.
But they're willing to make room for it. And they've had miniseries in one countries that get shown as films in others. That's happened for decades, you know, like Berlin Alexander Plots. And what's the Italian miniseries that was so great? The Best of Youth, a terrific miniseries that played as a film in America. So, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, things that get shown on a screen in one country, go to the movie theaters in another, get on TV in a third. So where does it all end up? I don't know, but they're going to want to recognize the art and where business is happening and money's being made. So I imagine the rules will get tweaked as we go along.
Yes, absolutely.
And what is a film? Is it a film only if you go into a movie theater and sit in a seat? What if you go to a warehouse and put on goggles? Is that a film?
Well, okay, so you're talking about something that, in a way, we can't really talk about yet, or at least not my, I can't talk about yet, because I haven't seen it yet. But Alejandro Iñárritu, who, of course, has won not one, but two Oscars for Best Director for The Revenant and Birdman, he...
Good Lord, that's not right.
It isn't?
I mean, it may be accurate, but it shouldn't be true. But anyway,
okay. Well, that said, he is here with an installation that is a little bit out of can at a warehouse called Carne and Arena. Actually, it's Carne e Arena. It's, I guess, about you know, immigrants crossing the desert to get into the United States, and it's all a virtual reality kind of installation. Eventually, it's making its way to the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. I'm going to see it tomorrow. You have to book time because only one person can go through at a time, and it's a 6.5 minute kind of adventure, so to speak. And I've heard it is the best VR thing that has ever been done.
Well, it's like an experience. It's a kind of amazing experience. Your roommate Stephen Garrett said it was just absolutely wonderful. He just was blown away by it.
Yes, and by roommate you mean roommate here in Cannes.
Yes, I'm not outing you.
No, I meant you know, not in the United States.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds really fascinating. It sounds Variety or a Hollywood Reporter reviewed it and described it as akin to that early period in film when you had the great train robbery and a guy pointed a pistol at the screen and fired it, and you always hear reports about in theaters, people scrambled out of the way. They didn't know what was, they were freaked out. They're like, oh my God, that guy's about to shoot at us. It just felt so real, and you sort of giggle and go, oh ha, isn't that cute? Back in the day, they didn't even realize what was happening. And he says, you know, that's kind of what happens with this. You know, there's a helicopter overhead and you cringe and you're trying to get out of the way, and there's security guards, you show up with guns and you're scrambling to hide. He says, you know, it's a visceral, emotional, it really feels like you're in there in and of the moment. And it feels like the first step towards some new art form. It's not that it will replace film in the sense of the narrative story that we have, but this, like video games and other things, you really feel like, wow, there's a lot of possibility here. It's really fascinating, and I wish I could be there to see it. I wish it would come to New York.
Well, I wish you were here. We could go to the morning screenings to see some of these movies.
That's right. So Wonderstruck, I think we touched on last week, is the Todd Haynes film. I think you guys are a little mixed. Some people think it may be Oscar bait. It's based on a best-selling children's book, which is sort of a graphic novel that combines with a text novel. It's
correct.
An innovative book. It's an innovative movie to a degree by combining two different storylines that they come together in an interesting way. It's
yes.
Got sort of a mixed response, but, you know, it's Todd Haynes, and it's a classy adaptation. We'll have to see where that ends up. The movie I'm really excited by is a Russian film called Loveless. Tell me about that.
Okay, well, you know, Loveless is directed by Andrei Zvyagintsev. He directed Elena, which was in Cannes in 2011. It was kind of a twisted and dark story. It was screened in Un Certain Regard. Leviathan was here in 2014. I thought it was going to win the festival. That's how good that film was. It went on to be nominated for the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. It did win the award here in Cannes in 2014 for Best Screenplay. And that film really touched on some socio-political issues going on in Russia, and so does Loveless. It's a film about a husband and wife who are divorcing. In fact, they've actually found new lovers, and their child goes missing or runs away. They can't find him, and the search for him during the course of the film, Zvyagintsev goes and he's kind of commenting on the socio political issues that are affecting Russia today, but in a very kind of subtle and sometimes sledgehammer way. Sometimes he's very subtle about it, sometimes not so much. But it's very, very good. And there is a moment in this film that is just devastating.
So that's three very good movies in a row from him.
Yes, this guy knows how to make a movie. And so far, it seems to be everybody's favorite for the Palme d'Or. And it also started, you know, lots of cell phone usage in this movie. And there's a lot of filmmakers are beginning to comment on mobile phone usage and how we're all sitting at the dinner table with one another, but we're all looking at our phones.
Mm-hmm. Well, The Lobster was a favorite of mine from last year, and the director of that film has a new movie called Killing of a Sacred Deer. Sounds like another oddball feature, and also starring Colin Farrell and Nicole Kidman, who has like three films at the festival.
Yes, okay, so this is the first of at least two films in competition for Colin Farrell and Nicole Kidman, who are starring in together in both of them. This is a film by Yorgos Lanthimos, who you saw his film here, Dogtooth, many, many years ago. Mm-hmm. He then had The Lobster a couple years ago, which starred Colin Farrell. And it's kind of a psychological revenge horror film. And Nicole Kidman and Colin Farrell are married. They have two children. And Colin Farrell's character is a heart surgeon. He has a little bit of a friendship with a teenage boy who his father died. Turns out Colin Farrell was the surgeon who, through an accident, killed the father. The boy wants revenge, and how he goes about getting that revenge on the family is, I'm not going to give anything away, but Colin Farrell is left to make a very interesting and very difficult decision.
Well, one of the movies that had sort of raised eyebrow anticipation, by which I mean, okay, that sounds like it won't work, but maybe it will, is The Redoubtable, which was a film by the director of The Artist, which was an Oscar triumph, of course, in 2011. And this was a biopic about Jean-Luc Godard, which sounds awfully audacious. And in fact, most people thought it didn't work.
Yeah, this was a film that actually got booed. I mean, that's like the big thing in
Canada.
Like
a real boo.
Yeah, I mean, when Netflix's logo came up on the big screen at the Grand Palais, it got some boos. But
that was more like a joke, wasn't it?
There were some serious, some kind of like, oh, don't we have to boo this?
Why would anyone boo Netflix? I thought it was like a joke. I thought it was people going boo, and everybody giggled, and that was sort of it, you know.
I think it was both. It was like there were some serious, there were some not so serious, but then afterwards, everybody giggled anyway.
Okay, and The Redoubtable just is not very good.
No, it's about Jean-Luc Godard in Paris, 1967. There's the big student uprising, and then, of course, they all came to Cannes, Godard, Truffaut, and lots of filmmakers, and they shut Cannes down that year. They canceled the festival like during the second day.
Well, it's 68, a year of riots and uprising,
yes,
and student
year.
Protests all over the world.
Yes, and it's about his relationship with Anne Wyazemski. I'm mispronouncing her name, I'm sure. He married her in 1967, 20 years his junior, in fact. And it was about their marriage, and I think it lasted a year and a half or 2 years, and it's about that.
And it's not good.
No, it's not good.
Right, and similar reaction for Sofia Coppola's bizarre remake of The Beguiled, a Don Siegel film starring Clint Eastwood. It was set during the Civil War. I hated the movie when I was a kid. I was in the hospital for some reason, and it was on TV, and I was like, what is this? I was like 11, and I could not handle it. I just didn't like it at all. Women were wandering around the plantation. They were very weird, and I've never watched it since. I'm just like, I hated that movie. I just didn't. I love movies, and I loved old movies, even at 11. That one I probably perhaps wasn't old enough for, but I've had such a negative reaction to it at the time. I never wanted to see it. And now that it's been remade, I was like, why in God's name? But apparently the idea is sort of a feminist remake, but everybody sort of shrugged their shoulders at it, didn't they?
Actually, yes. They either went, oh, you know, it's a fine film. I don't know what it's doing here. That's basically the takeaway is, you know, people said, wow, it was a really competently made, beautifully made film that's very commercial and very approachable.
Very commercial.
Yes, it is. It's a commercial film.
That's not
film.
What Variety and the Hollywood Reporter said.
Well, what they're probably saying is it's not going to make a lot of money, which is also probably
true. That's the definition of commercial.
Well, okay. I think it's going to do just fine if it's marketed properly.
Really?
Yeah, I think it'll be fine. It stars Nicole Kidman and Colin Farrell. How wrong could you go?
That's not box office gold. An art film with Nicole Kidman and Colin Farrell. I mean, Colin Farrell was in The Lobster. That made $2 million or something.
Well, okay.
They're fine, lovely actors, but they're not box office gold by any imagination.
And Kirsten Dunst is also in it. It's basically about a Union soldier who is injured, who is taken into a Confederate home for wayward women, and of course he then winds up beguiling them, and, you know, hijinks ensue.
Well, it only cost $10 million to make. We'll have to see where it ends up. They probably made their money back just by pre-sales, right?
Yes, the film was probably, well, Focus Features, I think, is releasing the film. So yes, that's true.
And then there's the Happy End, the Michael Haneke film. He won the Palme d'Or for White Ribbon and Amour, which is an excellent film. Amour is very atypical for him. It's not a warm film, but it has an emotional depth to it rather than his more typical austere style. And it sounds like Happy End is back to business as usual for Michael Haneke.
Yes, not only is it business as usual, he's 77 years old, and, you know, he's kind of, a lot of people think this might be his last film, and he's doing a best of kind of all of his themes and motifs he has included in one film here, although it's done so artfully and so well, he really knows how to craft a film.
And one person that looks like they may have a promising future is Sean Baker. He did Tangerine, which he famously shot on his iPhone. I thought it was one of the best films of the year. I thought it was just terrific. But I wondered, you know, he had non-actors. It was shot on an iPhone. I didn't love it because it was shot on an iPhone, but I did think it looked really cool. And you couldn't help thinking, was this some sort of bizarre, you know, alignment of the planets, or does this guy have actual talent? You think he does. If you really like a movie, you have to think that. But he's followed up with this movie called The Florida Project, and it sounds like he's proven himself he's in it for the long haul.
Yes, this is a film that is set in a dumpy hotel in Orlando where people, you know, pay by the week or they pay by the month. They're kind of the hidden homeless. And it centers on a 5-year-old little girl and her very troubled, very young, very tattooed, so unfit to be a parent mother. And all of the it's one of those slow burns where, like, halfway through the film, I kind of turned to Steven and was like, I hope something happens in this movie because this is taking forever and nothing's happening. And it was just by the end, it had gripped you and it's just wrenching. It's a great film, probably the best film I've seen so far here in Cannes this year. And it has a five-year-old girl in a performance that, frankly, I would pick up this film if only to give that girl a run for the Oscar.
Yeah, really?
Yes.
Best supporting actress?
Best actress or best supporting actress. She is that good. And definitely, look, if I'm totally forgetting the name of the film that Kavanzane Wallace was in when she was nominated for an Oscar when she was, I think, 8 or 9 or 10. But same thing.
Ah, you mean Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Thank you. You know, I think the cold is getting to me. Yes, Beasts exactly. of the Southern Wild. And it was a performance like that that was it will be so memorable. And frankly, the only other memorable film that I would want to talk about is The Square, which is really, it's from Ruben Östlund, who is a Swedish filmmaker, I believe. It's playing in, he had a film here a couple years ago in Un Certain Regard called Force Majeure that everybody loved. This film about a museum curator who's putting on an exhibit called The Square, in which visitors are encouraged to enter a square in the museum, and then, you know, they're supposed to be altruistic in that space. Well, he gets his wallet and mobile phone stolen at the beginning of the film. Getting it back and how the curator deals with people throughout the rest of the film is this idea of being altruistic and helpful and the obligation to be helpful to others is the theme that is explored. Ironically, going back to the security issue here in Cannes, that film started like probably half an hour late, and the press getting into that screening, it was the 7 o'clock screening, the scrum, the elbows, the pushing, the shoving. I thought, maybe this is all part of the movie. You know, maybe they're trying to show us, look at what you did before this movie. Watch this movie and you'll see you should be nicer to one another.
So that's already 3 or 4 movies that sound like they could be on a best of the year list. Loveless, The Square, perhaps the deer movie, what's it called? Killing of a Sacred Deer, and then The Florida Project.
So far, The Florida Project, definitely.
Oh, all right. And not Loveless.
Loveless, yes, absolutely.
Well, that's two. That's two so far. That's pretty good. If you can get 3 or 4 movies from Cannes that are among the best of the year, I always feel like it's a good festival. What, anything you're looking forward to coming up? I know that Lynn Ramsey is still working on her movie.
Yes, the rumor is that Lynn Ramsey, a filmmaker who has been here in Cannes before, is literally doing the mix of her film today so that she can bring it to Cannes on Friday. The name of the film is You Were Never Really Here. I will unfortunately not be here when that film premieres on Friday.
Shades of Wong Kar Wai. Well, I think that wraps up Cannes Film Festival for the moment. I look forward to hearing about the rest of the movies you get to see and the virtual reality project. That I'm very excited to hear about. Spoken as a guy who, shrugged his shoulders about VR, but now it's here. Now there's actual content being created, interesting stuff, and I'm excited to check it out. But I'm also excited to find out what's going on in the world of books.
Yes, indeed. It is time for our book filter segment where, Michael, you pick a few books for us to really pay attention to over the next week or two. And often they're ones that are ready to be optioned by the industry. So, Michael, what should Hollywood be paying attention to this week?
Well, I've got two books on my mind. One is by Jeff Shara. He's the son of the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning The Killer Angels, which was a novel set during the Civil War, turned into a miniseries, just an acclaimed work. And Jeff picked up his dad's work and has done a string of novels set in and around the Civil War. And if you know anything about the Civil War and Abraham Lincoln in that era, there's like 1,000 books a year are published on that topic, fiction and nonfiction. That may be an understatement. I think if you're like trying to write something about Gettysburg, you're probably like elbow to elbow with all the other scholars and all. I mean, like, it's just an unbelievable scrum. Talk about Cannes. And so Jeff, I think, has decided to move on a bit. He's moved on to the Korean War. He has a book called The Frozen Hours. And it's really a forgotten war in terms of America, even though one of our most famous TV shows of all time was set during the Korean War, and that's MASH. Though, of course, people really understood MASH as being about Vietnam, but technically it was set during Korean War. And this book takes place where U.S. forces are squaring off against Chinese forces in 1950. They've been beating the Koreans, and then a couple hundred thousand Chinese forces come down from China in a battle dubbed the Frozen Chosen, which sounds like a boxing match. But it was a nightmare situation, bitter winter weather. The U.S. forces were outnumbered 6-1. And so that major battle in the Korean War is immortalized and brought to life in this book, The Frozen Hours. And I do think that the Korean War is ripe for reappraisal on TV and film. It's just something that we almost never discuss. I know that Ken Burns has a extensive, I think it's like 18-hour documentary about the Vietnam War coming up in the fall, I believe, or next spring. I'm very looking forward to that. And maybe Jeff Shar can start to bring more attention to the Korean War. However, there's also another book I'd love to mention as a property. I mean, The Frozen Hours could be a movie, a miniseries, who knows. But there's a fun romance book that I'm just in the middle of called The Lady Traveler's Guide to Scoundrels and Other Gentlemen. And this should be a TV series. It's a great setup for a series. It's about a bunch of elderly women whose husbands were adventurers and travelers, and they're now widows, and they've fallen on hard times. So they decide to start a ladies' club for women who want to travel the globe, which is quite a shocking thing to do for women back in that day, especially if they didn't have a man with them. And so they start this club, one of their members gets lost, and a dashing gentleman must go off with that woman's friend in order to find her. Of course, romance ensues for them, but I just love that these little old ladies, it sounds like the Grand Budapest, not the Grand Budapest Hotel, it sounds like the second best Marigold Hotel. It sounds something like that, with cute elderly people launching a business in the Victorian era, sending women around the globe on adventures, dashing gentlemen in their wake. It just sounds like it could be a very fun premise for a series. The BBC should look at it right now.
Well, what we're going to look at is some of the top entertainment news stories from the past week, because it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, it's kind of big, actually, our first story, because
There's
King
no
Kong...
There's no looking around on this one.
Oh, yeah. Well, how many puns can we make about this?
I don't know. It's driving me bananas.
Don't make me laugh. I'm sick, remember? King Kong is coming to Broadway, the sort of musical which features a full orchestra and songs, but prefers you think of it as a drama with music. Well, it's headed to Broadway in 2018. It opened in Australia, where everyone loved the ape and precious little else. Multiple big names have been attached to the show since then. Now they've finally committed to Jack Thorne, who wrote the smash hit Harry Potter play, and lyrics by an Aussie composer rather than a team of pop stars. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. You know, this is a show that they've had different teams attached to it over the last 4 or 5 years. They bring in some big names, then they take them out. Then they bring in other big names, they take them out. There's no sense that they've actually cracked the nut on this one. They're just, they've got their latest team and they've got the Broadway house that's available, which is Miss Saigon. When that goes, they're going to move in because Harry Potter took the space they wanted, the biggest house on Broadway. So I think they basically just said, all right, we got a house, let's go. So they're just going in, just like making a movie before you got your screenplay done. Could it all work? Sure. But they've got a musical where the songs and the book are not any good. So they've got a lot of work to do. Everybody likes the ape. But, you know, it's going to be a big year in 2018. You're going to have Frozen the musical. The Harry Potter plays will come to Broadway. And now we've got this monster coming. So it'll be fun. But, you know, we already just ended a good year for Broadway. It's a record $1.4 billion for the 2016-2017 season. Thank you, higher ticket prices. Ticket prices have really exploded, not just because of Hamilton. Across the board, you got a hot new show, you're paying $300, $400 to see it. If it's Bette Midler, you're paying $800. They've really bumped up the ticket prices. But that's not the only reason it's big. It's also big because of attendance. Last year was the second highest attendance ever in total numbers. However, the way Broadway looks at it is how many shows have been running this season. Because theaters go dark, new shows aren't ready. And so of the actual weeks of performance that were available, attendance is actually up. There just were fewer weeks this year than last year, so the comparison falls down. So it's the second highest attendance of all time, but it's actually the highest of all time if you look at how many people attended the shows that we actually could go see. Does that make sense? Have I explained that well? You know, sometimes a Broadway house, one show will close, and it will take 4 months before a new show can open. And those four months become dark weeks. And so there's no shows for anyone to attend at that theater. So how they figure out how many weeks have been playing that year, they say every show on Broadway and how many weeks they were open, and that's the total number of weeks. And when you look at that and see how many people went, you've got a really good number. So despite rising prices really hitting record levels, people are flocking to Broadway more than ever.
Okay, did I mention I'm on cold medication?
Yeah, well, that's why I'm trying to carry all the heavy lifting for you.
Well, I appreciate that. Ramadan. I know that's kind of a hard transition from Broadway to Ramadan. Well, Ramadan is beginning around May 27th, so get ready for some great television. Wait, what? Yes, television. Ramadan is, of course, a month-long religious period in which Muslims around the world fast during daylight hours and then break that fast at night, often with family and friends around. TV networks have caught on and taken to launching big new shows during the month. Think of it as, like, the Middle Eastern equivalent of the Super Bowl for 30 days straight. That would be kind of nice. Everyone is home, everyone is surrounded by friends, and everyone enjoys some fun TV for the whole family. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal just because we didn't know about it. It's fascinating. We often talk about the UK and their tradition of a lot of TV on Christmas Day. Every show has like specials. Knowing that it's happening for Ramadan really piqued my interest. There's one show I definitely want to check out called Black Crows, but it's just a fun fact that I wasn't aware of.
Up is down and black is white, and MSNBC was the number one rated 24-hour news channel last week. Oh, and by the way, Fox News is third, at least in the key demos. Here's a dirty little secret.
What?
Yeah, I know, it's pretty remarkable. For 24-hour news channels with a political slant, it's better to have the opposition party in the White House. That's one reason MSNBC has leapt to the top of the ratings board. MSNBC and Rachel Maddow hit 2.44 million viewers in prime time, just edging out Fox, which has, I think it was at 2.41 million.
Mm-hmm.
But those Fox viewers are getting older and older and older. They soon I'll be a Fox viewer. They ranked third in the key demos of 25 to 54. So Anderson Cooper of CNN beat Tucker Carlson. Rachel Maddow beat The Five. And at 10 p.m., Lawrence O'Donnell at MSNBC beat Sean Hannity. So what was MSNBC preparing to do? Dump O'Donnell until news that they weren't even trying to renew his contract leaked out and viewers spoke up. Now they're negotiating. Is all this a big deal, a big whoop, or should it be covered by MSNBC?
It's a big deal. It's you know, the changes in the 24-hour news channels like late-night TV don't happen very often, and it's happening here, and it's partially due to the White House. So like CBS said, you know, Trump is bad for the country, but good for 24-hour news channels.
Jordan Peele He has a follow-up to his horror blockbuster Get Out, and anyone following Book Filter will have already heard about it. The horror novel Lovecraft Country, touted on this very podcast, in fact, is going straight to series for HBO. It's set in the 1950s Jim Crow America. It doesn't use horror as an allegory. In this case, the racists are also in league with malevolent dark forces from another dimension. Yeah, that's great. Each episode works as a standalone horror tale, like The Haunted House and The Evil Boss Who's Really an Alien Creature, combined with an overarching story. I think I had a boss like that once. Big deal or big whoop.
Yeah, you worked in Hollywood. Of course you did. It's fun. Hey, right? Do you remember this story? I talked about this novel. I loved it, and I'm very excited to see it's happening as a project on HBO.
So I'm going to start whipping through some of these stories. Jimmy Kimmel will be back after almost setting a record by waiting until the last minute to name a host for the Oscars in 2017. This time they've done the opposite and announced Kimmel will return as the host for the 2018 Oscars. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop, because Sperling has to get to a screening in 10 minutes.
Wow, that's okay. So yes, we are whipping through these, actually. HBO has officially canceled its collaboration with Jon Stewart, which we discussed on this very podcast. This was for a series of animated shorts. The digital pieces were originally meant to start during the elections and maybe be daily and topical and give people, you know, another reason to subscribe to HBO Now. They never appeared. None of these shorts were ever made. And by the way, the guys from South Park could have told Mr. Stewart that doing even shoddily animated shorts on a timely basis is really, really hard. Stewart was stumped. HBO said, "Take your time." And then everyone said, never mind. Big deal or big whoop.
It's the most unnecessary announcement of the year. You know that thing you didn't understand that we never did? Well, we're never doing it.
Hollywood has been involved in its own version of The Ransom of Red Chief in recent weeks. In that classic O. Henry story, a little boy is kidnapped and the criminals demand a ransom. The parents just laugh it off, knowing the little boy is such a handful that the kidnappers will soon gladly return the boy for free just to get him off their hands. Yes, it was a more innocent time back then. That's not quite what has happened in Hollywood, but hackers stole Orange is the New Black. They stole the whole season, and they demanded ransom, and as far as we know, the studio, Netflix, ignored them. Then Disney announced a movie of theirs was being held hostage, but they refused to pay up. It's widely believed to be Pirates of the Caribbean. Maybe the hackers saw the reviews? I don't know. This refusal to pay up matches what happened in the business world after a recent spate of hackings that included ransomware, ransom demands. They just ignored them. All these companies just went, yeah, we're not paying it. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I think it's the only way to keep them from happening in the future. You cannot cave. Otherwise, you have to pay the price short term, but I think long term it's the right thing to do.
Hey, Michael, I've always wondered about this. Can you copyright a joke? I think you can. It's not as easy as it sounds, though, especially
take my
when.
Wife, please.
Yeah. By the way, you owe Don Rickles some money. Was it Buddy Hackett? Yeah.
No, Rodney Dangerfield. No.
I don't know.
No, Henny Youngman.
Yes, that guy. Pay him. Well, as I was just saying, it's not as easy as it seems it should be, especially when those jokes are topical ones. Jokes like, boy, is Trump a dunderhead, and the like. Well, Conan O'Brien is going to find out because he's going to trial over accusations that his show has stolen jokes from one particular online comic. This isn't a nobody. It's a comedy writer who says Jay Leno used more than 1,000 of his jokes and has had work published in the New York Times and the Washington Post. He insists Conan's show stole jokes about Caitlyn Jenner, Tom Brady, and the like. A judge agreed there's enough evidence to go to trial. In every case, it would seem a writer in the joke room submitted the idea for approval. Have you heard the one about the blind man who wanted a divorce? Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. It could be like Blurred Lines. Hopefully they get this right if it goes to trial. I don't think it actually will. Seems like the guy has some timing case, but they want to argue, no, we came up with it independently. It's not easy to do. We'll have to see where it ends up. But if it goes to trial, it will be very interesting because it is sort of uncharted territory.
You know, if I had enough time, I would go into how basically comics submit jokes to the Tonight Show and, you know, basically all of these late night shows.
The Kids in the Hall.
Yeah.
That's what Carson called them.
Yeah. They get about $25.
Mm-hmm.
Universal Music wants their money back. The record label made a deal with the estate of Prince, of all people, for access to all sorts of music, both released and in the vaults. It gained tons of attention and it involved tons of money. Little problem. The estate had other conflicting contracts with other labels. The whole mess was compounded by infighting by the heirs to Prince's fortune, and a representative, some claim, was acting in conflict of interest. Universal finally has said, just give us our money back and void the contract for Pete's sake. The estate tried to demur, saying, well, we may have spent some of it, but Universal says, give us the money or we're suing you for a lot more. Big deal or big whoop?
In the scheme of things, it's a big whoop, but the estate is a mess and hopefully they'll get their act together.
Yeah, well, I know we teased Inside Baseball, which is our segment where we discuss the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. But you know what? As you mentioned, Michael, I'm in Cannes, deathly ill, but I actually have to run to another appointment because that's the way Cannes is. Sometimes you don't get to stay for the ending of a movie. Sometimes you don't get to stay for the ending of a podcast. And that's that's what we've run into today. However, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes or the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, the Google Play Store, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, you can find our show. We do urge you to rate and review the show there. Links to the stories that we discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us, those ways to email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox, or like us on Facebook. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular rock group MGMT. Much like we have a website, ShowbizSandbox.com, they have a website, WhoIsMGMT.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week is, oh my God, SperlingIsSick.com.
Yes, I actually own that domain, by the way. So... well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to the Huffington Post or, I don't know, michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. And until next week, play nice.